January 2008, and my name is David Gill. I'm interviewing Lord Carrington in London. Good afternoon, Lord Carrington. As an introduction, please could you briefly describe your career to date?
Well, what sort of career have you been?
Well, with regards to British nuclear history and British defence particularly.
Oh, well, I was Parliamentary Secretary. I was in the regular soldier in the army during the war, but I was then Parliamentary Secretary for the Ministry of Defence in the middle 50s. And then I was First Lord of the Admiralty when we had a navy from 1959 to 64, I think, 63, something like that. Then I was Secretary for Defence in 1970 to 1974.
I'm glad you mentioned those because I've got some questions about those in a minute. But
I think I got it right. I hope
that's pretty much what I have. So I mean, you can correct me. That's the beauty of your position. More specifically, and this is a question that we've asked everyone: could you highlight any role where you had responsibility for matters regarding the Mutual Defence Agreement of 1958, or where you collaborated with the Americans throughout that period, throughout your period?
Well, I mean, the Secretary of Defence, of course, I have a certain amount to do with it, but it was all, by that time, pretty well set in concrete. I don't think, really, I ever had much to do with the Americans. I had a certain amount to do with Admiral Rickover.
Yes.
When I was First Lord of the Admiralty, because we really needed the expertise for the atomic power for the nuclear submarines, which we didn't have, and it was necessary for us to get it from the Americans. And Admiral Rickover really ran the American nuclear fleet, or whatever, and he was the sort of mainstream of it. And he was actually not a very easy man in many ways. I'll tell you a story about him without finishing that. But we did get it in the end, partly due, of course, to Solly Zuckerman, who was absolutely wonderful, partly due to Mountbatten. And so we managed to get it. But that was the beginning of the nuclear submarine, but not of course, missile submarines.
Well, can I ask you a quick question on that? In terms of getting the nuclear submarines and Rickover, and specifically everyone on the British side, I mean, the big event that stands out in my mind is obviously Nassau. How important do you think Nassau was in terms of Anglo-American cooperation in the long term? Do you think
absolutely vital. Well, I had absolutely nothing to do with that. People kept playing this very close to their chests. Nobody really, I mean, only the Prime Minister and I suppose possibly one or two others at that time knew anything about it at all. And we had a great round table conference about this the other day at Chatham House. Do you know about that?
I wasn't invited to that, but I have, yes, Pete Hennessy's new book's out.
What came out of that was how little anybody knew
what was
going on. It was very interesting.
And
the fact that athlete didn't even tell his cabinet what he was doing.
But that
couldn't trust him. Is that what he said? Something like that.
Well, I don't remember the specific quote, but I think you've hit the nail on the head with that. Yes, quite. In terms then of everybody doing different things and there not being a lot of communication between the different groups, what would you have been doing during the time, specifically as Lord of the Admiralty, during that period? And do you think that had any immediate effect on your job or your responsibilities when obviously the MDA in 1958 and then Nassau in 1962? Do you think
we didn't want it. The Navy didn't want it because they thought that what was going to happen was that as always, money is short, and they thought that almost certainly what would happen would be that they would have to contain the budget for the nuclear submarines within the existing Admiralty budget. So they were only too anxious for the Royal Air Force to go on doing it. But of course, it didn't make any sense. I mean, for reasons we all know about, what was that damn thing called? Skybolt.
The cancellation of Skybolt, yes.
But it didn't turn out all that badly because we did get the extra money, so it was okay in the end.
In terms of the different departmental...
The Air Force, of course, were terribly upset.
Well, this is exactly my question. I mean...
Because they thought it was prestige.
Yes.
The Navy thought it was a heavy nuisance.
We were about 2 steps ahead of me. Yes, that was my exact next question. In terms of the rivalries between the Air Force and the Navy, I mean, was it tangible? Was it there? You know, how was it for you when you were there? Was it like a tangible difference between, or was it just kind of a hump?
The difference wasn't about the nuclear. The difference was about the aircraft carriers.
Okay.
You see, because they were going to be very expensive. And the Royal Air Force are very keen to have what they call the island strategy, with all the aeroplanes deployed on all the islands everywhere. And the Navy were very anxious to have 3 new aircraft carriers. And of course, in the end, it would have been idiotic to rely on the island strategy, because by the end of it, we didn't have any islands. they'd all disappeared, except for one or two. So the aircraft carriers were obviously the solution at that time. The difficulty, of course, was that the money, and since the Treasury really run this country and not the Cabinet or the Prime Minister or anything, the Treasury in the end scuppered them, even though we won the battle with the Royal Air Force.
This is brilliant. Okay. Thank you very much.
Then the Navy were very clever and decided they would have through-deck cruisers, which of course were aircraft carriers, really.
Mm. Brilliant. Okay, thank you. I'm going to come slightly back to the script for a second. Some of this may not be appropriate, but what I'm more interested in is your opinion at the time. So, a broad question is your understanding of the circumstances of the formation of the 1958 Mutual Defence Agreement and anything to do with the organisation and the technical exchanges preceding that. So, anything from 1958 onwards, your recollections or your personal memories of that?
I don't think I have any. I mean, there was the agreement, there we were getting on well with the Americans, they were giving us what we wanted, we felt we were independent, as far as we were concerned it was okay.
So why do you think it was that America decided to almost do an about-turn from their previous policies in 1958 and go on to, obviously, aid Britain in 1958 with the MDA, and then in 1962 with Nassau and Polaris Sales Agreement and so on and so forth? What do you think that they stood to gain?
I don't know. Loneliness?
Do you think there was...
I simply don't know why they did. Mm. And of course, the personalities and the people involved. I mean, Harold and Miller got on very well with the...
Absolutely.
That was there. But I suppose they decided we were reliable allies and part of NATO, and it was something. I never really knew how far, I still don't know how far the Americans helped the French to get their nuclear weapons. Mm. They obviously did something. So perhaps they were not quite so sort of selfish about their weapons they might have been.
Why do you think it was that Britain, you know, particularly in the 50s and 60s, cooperated with America more than, say, France, for example? Do you think there was a big difference in that sphere?
I think you have to remember the sort of after the Second World War. I mean, you know, everybody was beaten except us, especially the Americans. Some changed sides, but anyway, we in those days we were infinitely a bigger power than we are now. I mean, we really mattered. We were sort of part of the world power, and I think France at that time was not. The European Union had only just come into being. It was nothing to do with defence anyway, I think the Americans, and there was this sort of, after the war, which I was very minor way involved, the Americans but for them, we'd have been in the most terrible mess. I don't think I ever thought during the war we were going to lose it. But when the Americans actually came in and the Germans were foolish enough to declare war on them, one realised that we saw a way that we were going to win it. And so one had a very great admiration and respect and gratitude to the Americans. And so there was that very close relationship.
Did you find that at a personal level when you came into contact with Americans, there was kind of a close bond between you and at an operational level, even if not at a, just getting on with people or working with people?
Yes, it was very easy to work with. I mean, you did come across some Russians with them, who were very suspicious of anybody who wasn't to look over. there was that problem, but generally speaking, it was very easy. I mean, I went to see him. What was our first nuclear submarine? What it was called?
It would have been with one of Polaris subs. So
anyway, I went to see that. Quite early on. I mean, they were quite happy to. I mean, mark you, they were dead right. I didn't understand anything about nuclear. But still, it was an example that they were prepared to let you, into their sort of closest secrets in a way.
Do you think that's because there is a special relationship? There was a special relationship.
I think we both needed each other. The Americans needed us because Europe at that time hardly existed. We were helping to build the whole thing up. And we needed them because we were in a foolish way ourselves at that time.
So would it be fair?
A special relationship, yes, but I've never thought special relationship was a very good phrase. I think it's all the balls, if you ask me. I think for one reason or another, we needed each other. And later on, they needed us because we were the sort of bridge that with the European Union and so on. And I think language does make a difference.
So if we take those things, interdependence and language, and if it's not a special relationship, it's certainly not an ordinary one. That's fair. Would you think that's a fair assessment?
I think that this is more true on our side than theirs.
So we liked them more than they liked us?
We like to think that we need them, we do need them more than they need us.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay, thank you very much. During your career, particularly with regards to the nuclear side of things, if you could just tell me a little bit about the kind of people you worked with. You've heard briefly about that. Rickover and Mountbatten and everything like that, but if you could give a little bit more detail, that would be fantastic.
Well, Rickover was absolutely essential, and he was a difficult man in the sense that almost all naval officers in that day were WASPs, and he was a Pole, really, I think, and was regarded by quite a lot of people in the US Navy as being quite beyond the pale. The problem was, as far as they were concerned, the problem was he was head and shoulders above them in regards to the nuclear business. I mean, he really was responsible for it all, and therefore he was immensely important to us, and had to be wooed. I mean, he obviously thought nothing of the British. I mean, he wasn't very interested in us, but he had to be wooed, and he was wooed rather successfully.
And how did you go about wooing him?
Oh, well, flattery with Mountbatten, of course, in a sense. And then Sally Zuckerman had all the nuclear things under his belt, so, and he was a very persuasive character, Sally Zuckerman. Great man. And so it was personal, really, to a very large degree, although, of course, in the end, the Department of Defense and the White House could have blocked it if they wanted to.
So do you think that the relationship as a whole is built, or the foundations of it at least, are a personal basis? So none of this would work, even though there were strategic reasons which you mentioned earlier in Europe, and a common language and a common goal. Do you think it was the personal bond at kind of an operational level between senior ministers.
It helped. But one should never suppose that personal relationships ever, in the end, take precedence over national interest.
Right.
Because they don't. But they sort of oil the wheels. And certainly they did with McMillan and Kennedy and I suppose Churchill was always a sort of dominant figure even in his post-war days.
That raises an interesting question to me then, and kind of drifting slightly from the MDA, but in, obviously Edward Heath in the 1970s drifted closer towards Europe. Do you think that reflected a drift solely towards Europe, or do you think that reflected a drift away from an American relationship?
It offended the Americans quite a lot, yes. Because, I mean, his views was he wasn't anti-American. He wanted to be part of Europe, and of course, in doing so, the Americans felt that he was really dragging Britain into the European scene. I think it was very unfair in a way, because he wasn't anti-American. He was just wanted Europe to get together. But I think it did offend the Americans.
Okay. Right. This, I'm hoping, will be enjoyable for you as much as for me. Could you tell me about the highlights of your career recollections, everything since 1958, with regard specifically to nuclear cooperation? That's always the goal. But why you think that cooperation, or highlights that came from that cooperation, that couldn't have been reproduced in any other way?
No, I mean, I think we've really done that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was a question of personal relationships and common interests and all the rest of it.
Okay. Well, we've briefly gone over this, but I'd like to return to this ever so briefly. What other pressures do you think limited cooperation or the nature of the agreement? So what stopped America giving us everything and anything? Or do you think there were no limits?
I don't know. I expect there were. I imagine that they probably felt there were some things they didn't want to share with us, but I was never really so much involved in the nuclear business that I got to know that. But, some of your own mates at Chatham House, like Michael Quinlan, he was no much more about it than I would, because he was part of the team.
But I think, I know that you have kind of an experience of being there and being involved with it, and that's really what I'm after, like, the personal, how you felt about it, like, the personal relationship, things like that. I think that's what really makes the difference here. I think that's why that kind of a question is so important, because as you keep mentioning, it's the personal element that makes something special about this relationship.
The personal element has to be the Prime Minister and the President of the country. This kind, I mean, I don't think other personal relationships matter. I mean, unless you could persuade otherwise, I don't think they really came into it, but I think it was the McMillan. That sort of relationship, would really matter. But in the end, national interest failed. So I think the Americans may have felt that something they didn't want us to know, because it was in their national interest not to divide our troops. I don't know.
Okay, thank you very much. What do you think? I mean, this is one I'm quite interested in hearing your opinion on. What in particular do you think that the immediate benefits and long term benefits were to America, but equally, and I'm more pressed in this, were to Britain in terms of cooperation with America? So obviously nuclear access to nuclear technologies, but do you think there was anything from that that Britain gained specifically?
Well, other than the access to the nuclear...
Well, yes, did it encourage stability, do you think, in Britain? Do you think we gained, I should say, not we, Britain, do you think Britain gained, technological advances or stability or security, things like that, from that agreement? Or do you think that was kind of a...
It depends really whether you think that being at the nuclear top table was advantageous in terms of Britain's muscle in the world. I think it probably was. And certainly without the Americans, we would have had to spend, probably could have done it, but it would have, we would have had to spend a great deal more money, and that would have been politically very difficult, I think. So I think politically it was very useful to have the Americans on side. I think it put us in the league above those that didn't have it. I think this isn't really any longer true, because everybody's got it who wants it. But in those days, I think it was true. You see, it was a very exclusive club. And really, the British, the French, and the Russians.
Do you think Britain would have joined that club if it hadn't been for agreement with the Americans, so 1958 and obviously Nassau? You think Britain would have done it in? And how do you think it would have changed the nature of our deterrent? Do you think we would have remained an Air Force deterrent? Or would it? You don't know. Yes. Who would?
I don't know. It would have been much more contentious, because it would have been infinitely more expensive.
Mm.
So perhaps it wouldn't happen. And perhaps the Labour Party wouldn't go along with it, because they went along with the whole thing without any problem at all, as far as they were concerned.
Do you think then that although economics and particularly the cost associated with nuclear development are so high, that because it's dealing with, as you referred to earlier, national interest, that because Britain deemed them so important, we would always have a nuclear deterrent? It would always be at the heart of policy, and that's why cooperation with America was so important, because it had to be part of national interest, a part of national defence.
Hitherto, yes. I think that was true in the period I'm talking about.
Okay. Now, we've touched on this briefly. Do you think that the character of cooperation has changed broadly over the last 50 years?
Well, in a sense, you see, yes, because the Americans have become infinitely more dominant. I mean, they were the only superpower. They were the only superpower. And we were all, in a sense, hangers on. Although this was fairly obvious in 1945, because of the Americans and the Russians, it didn't sort of filter through in the same way. I think partly because there was still the British Empire, and we weren't just an island, and there was Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, all that. And I think we felt then that we really were a world power. And so, yes, is the answer to the question.
Thank you. Do you think that there are any broad periods that are drawn out? Because we talked earlier about the close period of collaboration in the 50s and 60s, and then the drift away with Heath, although possibly not intentionally. Do you think it's possible to segment between specific relations between the Prime Minister and the President and see the ebb and flow of the relationship, or is there always a consistently strong relationship between Britain and America?
I think there is a consistently strong relationship, but for example, Margaret Thatcher's relationship with Reagan was extremely important, and they were, she was a powerful figure. And it comes and goes, I think. If you look at the events of the last 5 years, I don't think that Blair was really important, really.
Do you think there have been prime ministers that are significantly more important and have significantly affected the, and I hesitate to use the term because we've agreed not to use it, but the special relationship, for want of a better phrase, that have gone and dramatically changed the nature of that relationship? Or do you think it's always been national interests that have...
Yeah, it's always been national
interests. So
people like to bang on about that special relationship, but it's always been national interests. I mean, there are a whole lot of reasons why there is a relationship,
yeah.
But it, not least language, and not least the position we have vis-à-vis Europe, and not least the Second World War, not least the War of Independence, and so on. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons, but it wouldn't. I mean, if our interests didn't national interests didn't coincide, it wouldn't last very long.
I'm thinking in the terms of national interests then, do you think there's a reason why the Americans didn't help, or France didn't accept the help offered to them by America? So in the 60s they wouldn't accept cooperation including Britain and America, or American weapon systems. Do you think that was because of pride, or a desire to keep it a completely national deterrent, or do you think it was something else?
Well, it was French. The French were immensely humiliated by being delivered from Nazism by the Americans and ourselves. And the Americans being rather more responsible and bigger and all the rest of it, they resented it even more with the Americans. Well, they are to come in and help us. Hence their removal from the military side of NATO, for example. They were damned if they were going to see the Americans dominating everything. There was Europe, and La France, La Croix, and all that sort of stuff. And it's still like that, really. I don't think it's changed very much.
You mentioned NATO there, and that's quite another interesting point I'd like to discuss with you. Do you think Britain's close relationship with America, and specifically on nuclear matters, affected Britain's participation in NATO? Do you think Britain always would have been so keenly involved in NATO affairs and European affairs, or do you think that it drew Britain closer in, whereas before it would have been more hesitant?
No, I don't know. I think it was always the same. It was in our interest in North Korea when NATO started in 1949, after the Cold War, people's realisation that Uncle Joe wasn't quite so cosy and all that. I think it was in our interest to see that Europe was not submerged under the communist regime. And you saw, Czechoslovakia, Latvia, Poland, all the rest of it. So I think we got scared and we had to do something about it. Annie Bevan was very greatly responsible for it.
Okay. So we talked briefly about the cooperation over the last 50 years. Do you think agreements such as the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty and the Polaris Sales Agreement, so kind of global events or specific agreements, have directly influenced the relationship in a noticeable way, or do you think it's still ultimately just national interest and national interest, and these treaties are additional?
Yes, it's national, but it's also sort of togetherness. It's nice to have friends. It's always struck me that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, I remember saying to an American friend of mine, what are you going to do? He said, oh, well, I'm going to learn. And they didn't at that time, in the early days, they didn't really think it was necessary to have friends. They do now. Things have changed. To that extent, that's true, I think. But that's true of all countries, not just the Americans. I think we have a good relation with the Americans. People are extremely critical of Blair. I got up and said I thought of going to war at the time, so I'm not being wise off to again. I said, it was a great mistake. But I do see why Blair did it. Blair did it for two reasons. One, because I think he genuinely believed that there were weapons of mass destruction. And he relied much too much on the security services, which is always a great mistake, because they have a difficult job, and they're quite often wrong. And secondly, he believed, above all, that the important thing was Anglo-US relations. And that's why he did it. Now, I happen to think he was mistaken, because Wilson got away with not doing it.
Exactly, yes.
I think it's a mistake, but I don't I don't think he was. He's a bad, silly man. I think he was mistaken.
Do you think there's always more of a tension associated, whether it's Blair, right back through 50s, 60s, 70s, there's a greater tension when we're dealing with Anglo-American relationship and a nuclear relationship and those kind of things? Do you think that the relationship is that much stronger and that much more stressed when there's events such as this, say, cooperation in NATO or the war in Iraq?
Well, you see, we've always shared all the sorts of secret things, their secret services, we're always collaborating in a way very, very closely, much more so than the Americans with other countries. Mm. So I think there's always been, this is all a remnant of the war, where we shared everything. And I think it still happens to a very large extent.
Do you think, and obviously there's no way anyone can know this, but do you think this will continue? Do you think this is, the nations are in some way bound together? Is this, what do you think will happen in the next 50 years, 100 years, in terms of a special relationship?
What's going to happen in the world? I don't know what will happen.
Do you think the relationship is strong enough to last significantly into the future?
Yeah, but what do I mean by relationship?
Well, in terms of, I think, two things. The first would be, will the relationship sharing, and specifically nuclear sharing, continue? So technological developments, sharing technological developments. Do you think that would continue into the future?
If it's in the American interest, it should.
And I think...
But I don't see why it shouldn't be.
With that answer, you've definitely answered the second question, which would have been a derivation of the first. This friendliness, this commonality between the two, and again, I think if it comes back to national interests, then, as you said, Eric, it may just affect the nature rather than the actual relationship itself. Yeah. If it's needed. Yeah. Now, I've got a few broader questions here.
Don't be too long, will you?
No, I'm gonna.
You've nearly finished.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Good.
I'm sorry. I do apologize. Do you think there's a case for increased interdependence between Britain and America? Do you think more could be done, more could be shared? And in your history, in your time involved with it, do you think more could have been done, more could have been shared?
No, I think given the circumstances, it went pretty well. I think it was pretty good.
Okay.
And I think the Americans were very generous too. You were saying, why did they do it? I mean, I think it's partly that they were very generous people, and they thought we did quite well during the war, so we deserved something.
Okay. I just ask you briefly about Russia, and I've got two questions, and then we are done. Do you think, or what do you think are the prospects for further bilateral arms control with Russia? So is there a realistic prospect of a control treaty, and can Britain do anything about that, so stopping other countries? And
I would have thought really that one ought to be much more worried about nuclear proliferation than the Russians. Iran and the rogue states that might get them. I would have thought that was I personally think that we were not very clever after the collapse of the Soviet Union, because they were, after all, they were the only other superpower, and it must have been pretty awful for them suddenly to become nothing. I mean, they became totally unimportant, and what we ought to have done, I think, was to stroke them much more, encourage them to be more, instead of which we didn't reach resolve. They don't matter anymore. And I think that was rather silly. I think that you see now, Putin, I think it's nationalism in the sense, we're going to show we haven't been written off. They just feel that they've been ignored and overlooked, and it's a proud country. And it must be very difficult to be left out of things when you were one of the two that really mattered. I think we mishandled it, I think.
Okay. The penultimate one is a lot of people at the moment are writing about British legal history and describing it as ambiguous because a lot of the details of the agreements weren't clear or have been reinterpreted and things like that. Do you think that's a fair analysis? And why do you think that's not fair?
I have no idea. I never saw the agreements.
But at a working level, do you think there was any ambiguity between the two nations or within British policy generally? Did you ever feel that by being, told one directive and then that would be contradicted by another government or another policy? Do you think that's a completely unfair label?
I never came across it anyway.
Okay.
So we always seem to be doing the sensible thing.
Right, last question. What would be your advice for the next generation of nuclear policymakers, scientists and technologists who have the opportunity to work together through the MDA agreement?
Well, the best thing would be that all nuclear weapons disappear, But they won't. Because you'll never get some of the ones, Pakistan, Iran, giving up, and the Israelis aren't going to give it up. All you must hope for is we get a greater control over those that have it and they come to their senses. I think the real danger of nuclear weapons isn't that the Russians are going to chuck them at us, the Americans are going to chuck them at the Russians, or we're going to use them or whatnot. The real danger is that the more irresponsible people will use them.
Mm.
And that's what's really awful. I mean, the Iranians would be deeply irresponsible, of course. And, get rid of Israel and all those of them, where are they? That's what really matters. And this, I think, is one of the outcomes of the Iraq War, which I disagree with, is that it's really set the Arabs against the West, and particularly against the Americans. And the Americans got a long, after Bush goes, they got a very long way to go, I think, to persuade the Arabs and other people in the world that they're really sensible, good, international people. I hope they can do it. If Hillary gets comfort, I imagine what she would do would be to make Bill Clinton ambassador at large with the object of making America respectable again. I mean, if I were her, that's what I'd do.
It's brilliant.
Because
he's
brilliant at it.
He's very successful. That'd be a very good idea. But it's a lot of ifs.
A lot of ifs. If she gets the nomination, if she gets in. I think it's going to be between her and McCain.
I think that's what The Economist said. Lord Carrington, thank you very much for seeing me.
Not a bit. I hope it wasn't very helpful, I'm afraid. I never thought it would be.